welcome to another episode of the Image Doctors. It's August 31st, 2006. I'm Jason O'Dell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
And thanks for joining us today on our every other week journey into the world of photography at Nikonians.
And Rockabilly, too.
And Rockabilly. And don't forget, you can get all of the podcasts from podcasts.nikonians.org, and make sure you check out our show notes there. We'll have all the relevant links to the stuff that we talk about in today's episode. So speaking about that, what do we have on tap for today, Rick?
Well, we're going to do some listener mail, start with a question there, and then we're going to do a mini review on the 105 VR macro lens. We talked about it when we were down at PMA, and we had a chance to try several of them out down there and liked the lens a lot. Since then, I've bought one of them, actually from our sponsor today, Robert's Photo.
Uh-huh.
So we'll talk a little bit about that and do an update on it, compare it to the older versions of the 105. And then last of all, we'll talk a little bit about landscape photography and what to put in your bag.
We did the essentials.
Similar topic a long time ago on wildlife photography. So this is the landscape version, which is a lot cheaper.
Yeah, and after we're done with that, of course, you're going to have your Nikon acquisition syndrome in full effect. You may want to go out and buy some of these products that we're talking about. All of them are available from one of Nikonian's sponsors, Robert's Imaging, Robert's Camera in Indianapolis. They ship around the world. In the United States, you can get them from www.robertsimaging.com, or just give their friendly sales staff a call toll-free at 1-800-726-5544. I've ordered many of my Nikon lenses from them, and I guarantee you they have great service.
Yeah, very nice people, too.
So let's start with opening up our vast mailbag of listener questions. And today we reach in there and we find one from Gary Lane in San Antonio, Texas. And Gary wants to know about mirror lockup, how it works, why do you use it, that sort of thing. So we thought we'd take a few seconds and answer Gary's question here on the air.
Yeah, that's a good question. And the whole idea with mirror lockup is if you're using a single lens reflex camera, you've got this big mirror in the mirror chamber there, and normally it's in the down position when you're just viewing and focusing. And then when you take the exposure, it flips up and allows the light to go through to hit the shutter. And then after the exposure is done, it goes back down.
Hopefully it hits your film or your sensor and bypasses the shutter.
Yeah, exactly. You kind of want that to happen. So that's what's happening. The problem is that when it goes up, it makes a big thwack, and you can hear it, especially on some of the older cameras. It's a pretty substantial thwack, and if you use a medium format camera, even more so. But the problem with that is when it goes up and hits that rubber foam stop, it creates some vibration. And if you're shooting at really short exposures, it's not too bad. And if you're shooting at really long ones, you know, several seconds, it's not bad. Turns out there's a problem zone there of about, an eighth to a 15th to a 30th, and right around there, you can get some vibration, especially under certain circumstances. You know, for example, if your tripod and tripod head, if those aren't particularly beefy, if you're using a little bit longer lens, it can be a problem. Macro can create some issues too. And we're going to talk a little bit more about macro
later.
So
if you really want to do, if you're shooting exposures in that somewhere between an eighth of a second up to a 15th, especially a 15th of a second, and maybe a little shorter than that, but in that zone, the mirror slap could potentially cause some blurriness in your images, even in under the best circumstances,
right,
is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly.
So the way you get around this is by locking the mirror into the raised position before you even take the picture.
Right.
Is that right?
Yeah. Now, with the older cameras, there was a little lever on the front of the body, typically. It varied a little bit from camera to camera, and you would just kind of flip it over.
And just move the lever
straight. That would lock it up, and you'd do that after you'd compose the photo and set it to the right focus. And then you just, you know, release the shutter with a cable release. And when you were done, you'd flip the lever back. And with some of the cameras, it was pretty easy to do, like the F2 and the F3 and the F4, it was pretty easy. The F5 had real pain in the neck lever that was really tiny and kind of wedged down between the lens and the grip, so it was a little bit tougher. On newer ones, what you'll do, and this is true on the D200 and the D1 and D2 series, I think the D1, I haven't really used that body, certainly the D2 series. It's got a concentric dial around the... Well, actually, we're looking at my F6 right now, yeah. So it doesn't probably have a film rewind lever on it. But
where the film rewind lever
would have been.
Used to be,
yeah,
you have the dial where you can change it between single shot or continuous shot. And if you keep twisting that dial on your D2 or your D200, you'll get
or F6.
You'll get to a setting that says M up, and that's where you set mirror lock up. It won't lock the mirror up mechanically. It does it before the exposure electronically. So the mirror will raise up, and then you have to depress the shutter release button a second time to actually take the picture. So when the mirror is locked up, just I know this sounds stupid, but I've made this mistake. You can't see, so you have to. You can't see through the camera because the mirror is in the way of the prism.
and oh, by the way, when you're done, remember to spin it back, because otherwise you'll be taking a regular shot, and you know all of a sudden the image will just go black on you, and you'll be wondering why your camera's
standing
broken.
Around, why you didn't take the picture.
Yeah. Yep. So that's how it works on that one. Now, on some bodies, there's a mirror delay type of release that you can set, and this is the case on bodies like the D100, the D70 series.
The D80 has this.
Yeah.
And this,
and actually the D200 does too. You can go a couple
as well
ways.
As the D2s. Mm-hmm. You have this other option.
Yeah.
And this is not true mirror lockup. It doesn't lock up the mirror, but what this does is it waits for it raises the mirror, waits 0.4 seconds, and then the picture you don't have to depress the shutter a second time.
Right.
You just have a lag time built in.
And it's not bad. I mean,
no.
If you have this and you're in those situations, use it. And if you think about that problem area on shutter speeds, you know, 8th to 15th, well, you know, the 0.4 seconds is just beyond that, so a lot of the vibration has died down at that point. So it's actually pretty useful. So if you have it, use it. It's not a bad feature, you know, whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And like we were mentioning earlier, it's not just for macro stuff. Really anything where you're, you know, wanting to do a large print or something like that where sharpness is critical, I would consider using it. Don't obsess over it if you don't have it. It's not the worst thing in the world. But it can make a difference.
One suggestion that I would make is with any of these modes, especially with the true mirror lockup, if you're trying to get rid of all vibrations, is use a cable release, electronic cable release or manual cable, whatever you might have, to take the picture, because that will reduce your hand creating vibrations on the camera body.
Now, one thing that you can do that will help if you don't have the mirror lockup is... place your hand on the lens and just press down a little bit when you release the shutter. And what that will do is dampen out the vibrations a little bit. You know, you want to be careful that you don't jar the camera, but it'll reduce that ringing that kind of happens when you release the shutter.
Some people put a bean bag over the top of their...
Yeah, I've always done it the easier way of just putting my hand, but that does help a little bit, just a little trick to do without the...
Now, before we finish, we should point out one difference. A lot of the newer digital cameras have a mirror lockup mode in the menus. There's a mirror lockup that's under the tools menu.
Yeah, good point.
And this is not mirror lockup for taking pictures.
No,
this
is for cleaning the sensor.
This is for cleaning the sensor. And on some cameras, you can get into this mode anytime. I know with the D2X, you couldn't get into that mode unless you were connected to an AC power source. But this is not for taking pictures. It disables the sensor altogether. So don't worry about that. That's not where you find mirror lockup. Even though that's
feature.
What it says. It says mirror lockup.
Yeah.
It's not what that's for.
Yeah. All right. So hopefully that helped a little.
Yeah. Thanks for the question, Gary. And if you have a question of your own that you'd like for us to answer on the air, please do send us an email to talkradio@nikonians.org, and we'll try our best to answer you, not only by email, but also get it onto a podcast. Mm-hmm. Now, our next topic is the 105 VR mini review. This lens was announced at PMA 2006, so back in February.
Yeah.
And we played with one there at the Nikon booth.
There were a bunch of them down there, actually.
They had them there for use. And
I think we went back several times, actually.
And I know that there was a mini review on the Nikonians website that JRP produced and wrote based on his experience there. And it's a nice, comprehensive mini review. And now that this lens has been out for a while, it's fairly easier to, it's easier to find them, and people have been using them. And I know you got one about a month or two ago, and you've been playing with it. So
yeah.
I'm eager to hear your. I mean, I know my initial feelings were all positive, but what have you come up with?
Well, you know what I would say is my feelings about the lens haven't changed. You know, the same things I liked that time I still like. The you know, what actually I've used it on the most is my F6, you know, a film body. And on a film body, you know, with the larger format size, a 105, I think, is awfully useful just for a lot of things other than macro even. You know, it's a darn good portrait focal length, and with the VR, it's very easy to handhold the camera at slower shutter speeds and get crisp images. The VR feature works really well. If you're shooting very, very close, you know, close to life size or half life size, you really want to put it on a tripod. You know, it just, you'll wear yourself out trying to handhold the camera at those kind of magnifications. It'll just kind of drive you nuts. So, you know, the VR feature is very handy for lower magnification things, you know, where you might be 1/8 life size, 1/10 life size, which actually I do a lot when I'm using
macros. You'd be surprised how much you actually do use that.
Yeah, because what I'll do is I'll throw the lens on the camera and then, you know, do a whole bunch of different kinds of shots up close, maybe on a tripod, and then further out and not necessarily on a tripod, and scenic things. And
now, so Nikon says, I mean, we were talking about the VR, which, as you say, is very useful. This is the newer generation VR.
Right.
This is VR2, correct?
Right.
And so that's supposed to give you some ungodly, like, 4 stops extra of stabilization as compared to... now, we always mention this, but we'll say it again. When you're using VR, it will not freeze action. Your shutter speed is still slow. It just keeps camera shake out of the equation at those shutter speeds. And it works really, really well.
Right.
So if you're in a museum where there's not a lot of light, and you're using a VR lens, you'll have an advantage.
Yeah. So situations where you can't use a tripod, and those happen.
And
or you just may choose not to because you want to stay a little bit more mobile. It is an alternative to shooting at some shutter speeds.
Right. I mean, a lot of people ask, well, why do you put VR into a macro lens? I mean, and you're right. When you're down at the closest magnifications, VR isn't going to matter because you need to be on a tripod anyway. The focal plane is so narrow, and you're down at 1:1 magnification or even 1:2 magnification, that any movement front or back towards or away from your subject will cause the subject to go in and out of focus. So it's much easier in general to shoot macro from a tripod when you're at those kind of magnifications. But for all those other times, VR is great.
Yeah, and it works very, very well. As we were talking about earlier, it does make a very nice portrait lens. One of the issues with the older 105 autofocus macro lens, and we've got it here with us actually, is that the out-of-focus areas of the image, you know, what's called the bokeh, wasn't as nice as other lenses. You could see a little bit of a double line effect. It was a little bit messier. And the new one just has this really smooth, nice-looking...
Real creamy background.
Yeah, very creamy background. And so it does make it very useful for portraits as well as macro stuff. So it's a nice lens. The manual focus action is a lot tighter and smoother than the old.
Yeah, it feels really good.
Yeah, it does. It's a lot nicer than the older autofocus lens, which is still a very good bargain, by the way.
And we should point out some differences between this and its predecessor, namely the new lens. In addition to having VR and the AFS focusing, which when I tried
it
was lightning fast, it was very good. It has a different, if I recall, there's a slightly different diameter for the filter size. Is that correct?
Yeah. The older one used the 52 millimeter filter thread. The new one uses the, a little bit more common, at least these days, 62 millimeter thread.
62 millimeter thread. Okay, so you would need to go out and get a different filter. Possibly. The new lens is also a G designation.
Right.
Meaning that if you're using this on an old manual focus film camera, anything prior to maybe an N70 even, or
like an
anything
F4
prior to an N80, you're probably not going to want to buy this lens. You're not going to be able to set the aperture. So it does require that. So that means there's going to still be a pretty healthy market for the previous version of this lens. Mm-hmm. You can get those used, which isn't a bad lens at all.
No. Now, in common with the former autofocus 105 macro lens, you don't need to use extension tubes to get down to life size, you know, 1:1, which is nice. And in fact, the new one will go even a little bit beyond life size, kind of a hidden little feature. An interesting thing that Jason and I were just looking at as we were comparing working distance mm-hmm. of this lens versus the AFD version of it.
And we should define working distance for our listeners who've never
good point.
Used that equation. There's the minimum focusing distance in the specs, which is the distance between the focal plane of your subject and the film or sensor plane in the camera. Mm-hmm. But the working distance is the distance between the subject and the front of element of your lens,
which is what you really care about when you're out
right.
using it.
And I've run into those situations when I was using my old Sigma 105 macro, which is another great macro lens, where I would get almost too close when I was down to 1:1.
Right.
The lens would start shading the subject because I would get so close to it, the working distance would get so small. And as a general rule, the working distance increases as you get longer focal length. So mm-hmm. a 200 millimeter macro is going to have more working distance than a 105 mm-hmm. and more, and that will have more than a 60 millimeter macro
yeah.
lens.
Now, the interesting thing is the new lens doesn't extend at all.
Yeah, it doesn't
change
length.
When you change focus, you know, nothing changes externally with the length as you focus, you know, to 1:1 or beyond. Whereas the older lens and most other macros will actually extend out, just like most lenses do as you focus them. And in general, what's going on with these macro lenses is that they're losing focal length as you focus closer, and that's why they don't have to extend out quite as much as an older macro lens. Like, we've got my old F4 version of the 105 here with me too, and that extends way the heck out. So the optical trick is they lose focal length, and therefore at the same extension can focus closer. But here's the interesting thing with this new lens, and this was a surprise to me. I figured because it doesn't extend, it might lose even more focal length than the AFD version, and therefore might lose working distance. But actually, it's got greater working distance than the AFD lens, which is kind of nice. And the combination of it not changing physical length and a little bit more room, you know, to insert flashes in there makes for a nice package. Now, one little tip on all of the macro lenses is that, or at least most of the macro lenses, is that they will lose aperture as you focus closer.
Right. And this is like adding extension.
Yeah.
You lose a little bit of light as the lens focuses
right.
closer and closer.
And if you're using one of those newer bodies, you can actually see it happen on the display, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
This is true for the Nikon ones. It's some of the other brands, like Sigma, for example, don't have a chip that's quite as sophisticated, so they won't show the drop in aperture, even though it's actually happening.
Right. Well, I just played with this on your F6
yeah.
here, and when I'm focused at infinity in aperture priority, it reads 2.8.
Mm-hmm.
And without touching anything, as I focus down to 1:1, it went all the way to f4.8.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you don't have to worry about this for your metering because it's all factored in.
Right.
But it is kind of... It could be disconcerting to someone who's seeing it. If you go out and purchase this lens, like from one of our sponsors maybe, and you're shooting it, it might read F3 or 3.1 even at 10 feet away.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a defect in your lens. It is totally normal, and it's okay. And,
yeah, and periodically you'll see notes on our site, you know, asking that question, is my lens broken?
Right. And,
no.
And I'll tell you, the first time I saw it, it could freak you out.
Yeah.
But don't worry about it. That's normal. That's what it's supposed to do. That's how they operate. And
yeah.
the bottom line is it's doing what it's supposed
yeah.
to.
And one last thing, and we'll talk a little bit about manual focus macros here quickly. The you know, as you were mentioning earlier, it's got the AFS focusing, which is very, very quick. Generally, you want to turn that off when you're shooting very, very close, because autofocus just becomes kind of a pain in the neck mm-hmm. more than a help. And so you're in manual focus mode. So here's something to think about, is if you're really wanting a lens just for doing high magnification macro work, You can also look at some of the older manual focus lenses. They're incredible bargains. Like the one that we've got here with me is an AIS 105mm f4 macro, and you know it's not quite as fast, but it's not really that much of a problem. It's very compact. It's smaller than either of the autofocus lenses that we've got here with us. The focusing action is super smooth.
It's like a dream.
Yeah, it's very nice. It even locks into place if you want it to. You have to use an extension tube to get down to 1.1. It'll just go down to 1.2. But it is a nice lens, and you can get these for less than $200 mm-hmm. in great shape. You know, just incredible bargains, and they're very sharp. And like we were saying, you don't really need the autofocus even want it.
In fact, when you're using a macro lens up very close, there's two ways to approach focusing, because the focal plane is so narrow, the depth of field is virtually non-existent, even at f. So you'll see a lot of those bug pictures and stuff on our website. A lot of times you're shooting these at f16, f22, or f32 just to try to get what little depth of field you can.
Exactly.
Two ways to go about focusing. One is you can either set the distance from your subject and then focus the lens and keep the distance to your subject fixed. Or you can set the lens to a particular focus distance, say like you set the lens to 1:1, and then you move your distance to your subject until the focus...
Move the whole camera.
Move the whole camera and tripod.
That's a lot easier.
And that's what a bellows is doing effectively too. You know, you're moving the whole, or a sliding ring, if you get a focusing rail on your camera, that's not a bellows, a focusing rail, you're moving the camera back and forth to change the camera to subject distance while you're leaving the mm-hmm. lens, because otherwise you have two variables that can change, front and back motion from you to your subject, trying to hold the camera still, as well as trying to focus the ring, and trying to get those two things synchronized up when you're very close is very hard. So you got to fix one of those.
Yeah. Now, the only issue with the older lenses is if you're using a fairly recent, less expensive Nikon body, something like a D70, a D50, a D100, or some of the equivalent film cameras, that lens won't meter. You'll have to, you know, make some guesses on exposure, mm-hmm. look at the histogram on a digital body. On a film body, you'll just have to bracket.
Or spend some money and get it chipped, but at that point, you know, you might as well look into getting a used 105.
But if you have something like a D2 series, a D1 series, a D200, et cetera, you know, think about the manual focus ones. They're remarkable deals right now. At any rate, some quick thoughts on the 105 VR.
Great lens.
Nice lens.
So we'll move on to our final topic of the day, sort of our big topic, which is what to put in your bag when shooting landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
And landscapes are, we've talked in the past about shooting wildlife, and it got pretty expensive pretty fast. The good news is that while you certainly can spend a lot of money, you'll spend nowhere near as much on the things that are most important for taking good landscape
pictures.
Right,
and you can actually go very inexpensively if you want to. I mean, just as an idea, bargain basement landscape setup, you know, go with film. You can do that. Get yourself a roll of Velvia. And you can use, you know, something as simple as like a Nikon FM or, you know, an FM2 or an FG or, I mean, there are a whole bunch of them that are pretty cheap right now. I mean, their prices have really come down. A few nice manual focus prime lenses like a 24 and a 35, you know, a 50 works great, a 105 works great for a lot of things. Those are all cheaper than dirt right now and very sharp.
And you can get great images.
Yeah.
In fact, if you spend the money in one area, I mean, other than optics, put it into having a good solid tripod and mm-hmm. head. That, in landscapes, chances are you're going to be shooting somewhat longer exposures. There's going to be things to deal with like wind, stuff that can blow your camera. You don't want a flimsy, cheap, lightweight tripod.
Yeah. It doesn't mean it has to be really expensive. You don't
just get something like a little bit more sturdy, you know, one of the better Bogan tripods, Manfrotto.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be carbon fiber. Those are nice, but you know, it can be aluminum.
Just something that's a little bit heavier.
Yeah.
There's a trade-off between weight and
stability.
Stability. Yeah. So you just can't get around it. But definitely that's where something like a nice ball head, like a Markins ball head or a Kirk or a Really Right Stuff ball head, and it makes it just so much nicer to adjust.
Yeah, those are great for landscape stuff.
And maybe a bubble level, mm-hmm. stuff like that. But we'll talk about accessories in a little bit.
With lenses, you know, it's kind of funny. I think you can either spend a lot and get good value, or you can spend very little and get good value. But the middle range is mm-hmm. kind of interesting. I think what you want to stay away from when you're shooting landscapes is the more inexpensive zoom lenses, the ones with, you know, very sloppy focusing actions or a rotating front filter ring.
Yeah, and I think that,
and we'll talk about why that is.
Point is probably the most important factor, which is get yourself a lens that does not have a rotating front filter ring
right.
when it's focusing. But before we talk about specific lenses, let's get an overview of the kinds of focal lengths you'll want while shooting landscapes. Mm-hmm. You have your three categories. You have your wide angle lenses, what I like to call your medium, your mid-range telephoto, and then your longer telephoto lenses.
Yeah, and you can use pretty much any lens for landscape.
You can do landscapes with a 500 millimeter lens if you wanted to.
Absolutely.
But it's tricky.
And sometimes you'll see comments about, oh, you need to have a super wide. Nah. Those are great for certain kinds of shots, but not for others. And, telephotos are great for some landscape shots.
Depending on whether you're shooting film or digital, most landscape shots, though, can be had with in the range between about 24 to 80 millimeters focal length.
That's pretty popular.
That's pretty all-encompassing.
On film.
Even on digital, you might want to go, and then wider than that, you can get a little bit wider on film down to maybe a 17 or 20 millimeter with a wide angle to get the truly wide stuff. And long for landscapes, even though, again, you can go all the way up to whatever you want, but long is somewhere going to be in your 70 to 200 mm-hmm. kind of range. I mean, that's where most of it's going to fall into. You're going to do most of your work probably in one of those middle categories, unless you like doing extreme wide angle
The key thing is that you probably don't need those, really fast aperture, really long lenses.
Right.
You can shoot stuff with them, but you really don't need
exactly.
it typically.
I mean, one of the reasons why is most of the time when you're shooting a landscape, you're going for depth of field. You're trying to maximize depth of field and sharpness. So chances are you're shooting at f8, f11, f16 most of the time. If you have an F4 lens that isn't as sharp, those just happen to be the nice, sharp, sweet spot apertures for sharpness. So you can get by with not having to buy the top-end lens because you're not using it wide open.
Yeah, you're really
autofocus
not.
Is less important. It's
right.
nice, but having AFS is not really
Yeah, actually, I
need.
Would say it's almost something that gets in your way because you're often shooting at hyperfocal distances.
Right. And we've talked about hyperfocal distance before. Check out the hyperfocal distance article at the Nikonian's
right.
resources if you're
the important thing is that very
it.
Often you're using manual focus.
Exactly. So it's not really critical. So we'll start from the wide end. If you're doing wide stuff, you probably on film that was some wide sort of used to be anything wider than like 35 millimeter focal length was considered wide.
Mm-hmm.
But generally wide angle really starts what we think of as wide angle really starts around the 20 millimeter focal length on film, that angle of view all the way down to 17.
Mm-hmm.
So the king of that lens would be like something like the 17 to 35 AFS 2.8.
Yeah.
But certainly not necessary. I used to use the 18 to 35, I think 3.5 to 4.5, and that was perfectly good on film.
Oh, yeah.
If you're on digital and you want something really wide, the 12 to 24 DX can't be beat, or some of the third-party lenses we talked about in our earlier podcast episodes where we did our super wide-angle shootout. The trick with all of these lenses, though, is that if they're really, really wide, you have to be careful how you use them, because the angle of view spreads things out so much that you really need to be close to have, you think in terms of your picture needs to have a foreground, a middle, and a background. And you have to get quite close to some of those foreground elements for them to be recognizable. Other than everything gets sort of
really
squished
close
into the background.
In fact, I would say uncomfortably close.
Yeah, to the point where if someone sees what you're doing, they think you're taking
idiot.
A picture of a
yeah.
bug or something
yeah.
like that, unless you say, hey, look through the lens. So if
yeah.
you're using those really wide lenses.
What you don't want to do is skip the foreground and just do that panoramic shot where you try to get everything in the frame. It seems good at the time.
It just doesn't work.
No, you get the shots back and they're
the
all just
details are just
deadly
too small.
Dull. Yeah.
There's not a lot in them. Alternatively, I mean, you don't necessarily need a zoom. You could go with a prime mm-hmm. lens here. If you're on film, the 20 millimeter is great. There's also an 18, and they get more expensive as you go wider. There's fewer low-cost wide-angle prime options, but a 20 millimeter or even a 24 millimeter, which is pretty inexpensive, the 24. I used
right.
to use that, and that's a great lens.
Oh, it is.
Great lens. If you're on digital, there's the 10.5 fisheye DX lens. That's not a bad one. But again, it requires a different way of thinking about your subject. So
now the key is, at least in my opinion, I think you, and I started talking about this a little bit earlier, you want to stay away from those lenses that have the really loose and sloppy focusing action,
right,
as well as a rotating front filtering. And here's the reason why. A lot of times you're going to use a polarizing filter on landscape shots, not for all of them, but sometimes you will. And you'll especially use a lot of grad filters. And the reason you use grad filters, yeah, the rectangular ones. The reason you use those, if you're shooting in the early morning hours where the light is nice and warm and interesting, or in the late afternoon, you've got these, you know, big contrast ranges, areas that are, you know, much darker than others, and you have to do something to balance out the light. And that's where you use the grad filters, which hold back the light in a portion of the frame and let it come through in others and, you know, balance the light shots. And whenever you see the really cool-looking landscape shots with a really nice, rich-looking sky with colors, yet the foreground is exposed correctly, those were almost always taken with grad filters or some fancy digital approach. You know, there are a couple ways of doing it. But grad filters are the most common way.
That's the get it right yeah. on the film
approach. And the problem is, if you have a rotating front filter ring, then as you change focus and adjust it and tweak it for your hyperfocal setting, the grad filter turns.
Yeah,
and now it's not aligned with the horizon, and then so you end up grabbing the grad filter while at the same time turning the focusing ring and try to get them lined up and positioned.
Yeah, it just gets to be
and
a
you
hassle.
Get them lined up, and then you bump it just by, you know, some careless action, which happens pretty easily, and now it's off kilter and your focus is off too. And you can do it. You can make it work. I've certainly
right.
made it work. But
there's
it's just
so many
nasty.
Lenses now on the market.
Yeah.
Especially in the mid-range zoom or that medium, you know, to normal focal length, you know, anything up to about 80 or 100 millimeters short of telephoto, mm-hmm. everything that's in that 20 to 70 millimeter range, there's so many variants of lenses, and most of them these days, the newer ones, not even expensive ones, have a non-rotating front
right.
filter, and so that's just something that you'd really want to look
yeah.
into.
Now, all of the Nikon primes have non-rotating fronts, so those are all good choices in that respect. Some of them have nicer focusing action, so just check it out. The manual focus ones are all good in that respect. And then if you go with the really expensive zooms, the 2.8 ones, those are really nice to use in a lot of respects because they typically have very good focusing actions. You know, the 35-70 is an exception. Very sharp lens, but mm-hmm. pain in the neck to use for landscape, at least in my opinion. But, you know, those lenses are pretty handy, but they are expensive.
Right.
There's no doubt about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, the top of the heap in that category, if you're on film, the 28-70 f2.8 mm-hmm. is
beautiful.
Is as good as they come. And matching that on digital is the 17-55 DX.
Yeah.
We both have that lens, and it's Incredibly sharp.
Yeah.
Just great. Because a lot of times with the landscape stuff, you're trying to bring out as much detail as you can. Mm-hmm. So if you have a better quality optic or you shoot stop down, you're going to get more of those details out.
Yeah.
But there's lots of, you know, in this category, the list could go on forever in terms of which one. There is no one lens to buy. If you have an 18-70 DX that came on your D70, hey, great landscape lens.
The best lens is the one you have.
That's right. Also, you might consider like a 35mm prime. Those aren't too bad. The 50mm prime AF Nikkor is probably the best performance for the dollar ever.
Yeah.
You can get them for under $100, so it's new.
Yeah. Now, we talked a little bit about filters. Let's talk just a bit more about that. And
The sort of the accessories. What kinds of things would you need to make sure you stuff in your bag if you're going out shooting landscapes?
Yeah. Now, I've got a whole bunch of grad filters in my pack. They're pretty nice ones. They're the Singray filters, which are not very cheap. But you don't have to have those.
Expensive, and I have those.
Yeah, they're not that bad. I mean, sometimes you'll hear things about, you know, color shifts and stuff like that, and they're probably a little bit less consistent, although the Kokins have improved over the last few years. But if it's a choice of having one or not, by God, get the Kokins, because they'll improve your photos tremendously.
Yeah, and they're still optically fine.
Don't worry about it too much. If you can spend the money on the others, great. But get them, either way.
And I would say start with like a two-stop.
Soft
edge.
Gradation, yeah.
Yeah, and that'll get you through. And sometimes then you might want to add a three-stop.
Yeah, I actually use the three-stop hard more than any other filter.
Really?
But, you know, part of it is that we live here in Colorado where the air is pretty thin.
Yeah, and the skies are bright.
Yeah, there isn't the humidity also to lower contrast ranges. So if you're shooting those dawn kind of subjects, very often there's a three-stop difference. That's what you want to hit. So I use that one the most, the two-stop soft right after that. And if you're just going to get two, those are the two that I would recommend.
And those are the two that I have.
Yeah.
The three and the two-stop soft.
Yeah. And I've got some of the other ones, even, you know, like a one-stop hard. I use that at times with film where the lighting is a little bit more even. It just kind of brings out the sky in a way that's a nice alternative to polarizing.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have the banding problem that you do. You know, with really wide lenses, like a 20mm lens, you'll have uneven polarization in the sky, and the one-stop grad won't do that.
So that's the other filter you probably want to put in your bag, which is a polarizer, because that can add some nice contrast to skies and clouds. It just gives you a lot more pop on the final image. And it also, as we've mentioned before, it takes glare off of water and glare off of foliage.
Right.
So anytime you've got a lot of trees in the picture, you'll get a much nicer-looking picture.
It'll really bring
out the
colors.
Highlights on the leaves. Of course,
yeah,
a good tripod.
Yeah, and you absolutely don't need to use polarizers just for skies.
Right.
Lots of shots I take where there isn't even sky in the photo, I'll use them, and it's just for what you were mentioning.
And you can use a polarizer to remove reflection or actually enhance reflection on water, for example. It works that way, too. If you're using an autofocus camera, and pretty much all the polarizers these days come this way, but you want to make sure you buy this circular polarizer. That doesn't mean that it's a circular filter. Of course, they are circular filters. But it just means it's the way that the polarizing etched filter is constructed optically. You want the circular polarizer. Otherwise,
as opposed to linear,
right,
which is the older variety.
And that could linear polarizers are known to screw up with autofocus systems. So you don't want to use those.
And they'll also affect the metering in some camera bodies a bit. Not a huge amount. It's usually, you know, just like a half a stop or so. But if you're buying a new filter, just buy the circular.
Now, if you're out there in the times to get the best light, which is early in the morning, sunrise, before there's harsh sun, or late in the evening, chances are you're going to be shooting long exposures.
Mm-hmm.
So another thing, in addition to that solid tripod and ball head that we mentioned, you're probably going to want to use a cable release. And this is where you might want to also consider using that mirror lockup function.
Right.
So if you're in the market for a camera, there's another reason why the film camera option can be quite nice for those getting into landscapes. Is many more of the film cameras had mirror lockup, even on the cheaper ones, than a lot of these digital ones do today.
And a lot of them had a delay mode, you know, with the self timer. Like if you were looking at an FM or an FM2 or an FE2 or an FA or any of those, they had a feature where if you set the self timer and then release the shutter, the mirror would come up. right at the start. It was kind of like the delay feature in a sense, although it was a bit longer. And those cameras didn't have the real mirror lockup, but it was a nice way of getting around that problem.
You could work around.
Yeah.
Right.
So, and you didn't have to set the self timer for the whole duration either.
And although you can probably get great pictures with digital, no matter which digital camera you use, a lot of times for landscapes, here's a case where it can be nice to have a higher megapixel camera.
Yeah.
A little more detail.
It just depends on how big a print you want
right.
to make.
If you want to make those nice 16 by 20 landscape prints, sometimes it's a little, and have room to crop.
Yeah.
Then that could be an issue. Otherwise, you know, there's a lot to be said about shooting something like Velvia 50 or, well, they don't make that anymore, but Velvia 100, mm-hmm. Any of the slide films.
Beautiful colors.
Just great colors. Looks wonderful. There's a reason why landscape photographers shoot that.
Yeah. And it's funny with the popularity of digital and the fact that it's been out for a few years now, we're starting to see a whole group of photographers that's never really shot film in any serious way. You know, maybe snapshots and stuff, but no slide film. And it is kind of a nice alternate experience and very well suited to landscape stuff.
So if you had to buy one thing, I mean, if you're just starting out, I would recommend get yourself a mid-range. Let's say you go out and buy a D80 tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the kit lens that it comes with is probably pretty good, but we haven't reviewed it. But let's just say, for example, if you had something like the 18 to 70 millimeter lens on a D80 or a D70 or even a D50, you're ready to go out.
Yeah.
You know, all you need is a tripod and maybe you go get yourself a polarizer. If you had to buy one filter first, consider getting the polarizer. You'll use it just in that many more circumstances.
And then right after that, you know, thinking inexpensively, I would say go get yourself a couple Koch and Grad filters. Mm-hmm. While you can do it digitally, you know, with merging exposures, the Grad filters are so darn easy.
Right.
And quick, and you know, getting it right in camera is often a simple way to go.
As you grow in your kit, you might look into getting a longer lens, like maybe the new 70-300 or something like that, because you can use that for a lot of landscape situations where either you're far away from the subject or you want to go for that compressed depth of field look. It can be very, very interesting. And then consider, lastly, something like a 12-24 or a super wide lens. Because I just think you'll use the super wide lens less often for other things in terms of having a general kit.
Unless you're me.
Unless you're... Yeah, but I'm talking about, like, you're not going to use the super wide necessarily on a random vacation. You might. It just depends on where you are. You can get by quite a bit with that 18 millimeter focal length that they give you.
I
use the 17-55, and for many of my shots, that is wide enough.
Yeah.
But for those times where you really want to play around with the super wide view, just got to understand that the mountains get real small in the background when you do
that. And everyone is different. You know, for shooting landscapes, my second lens would actually be the 12-24.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, like, you might be tempted to use a longer lens for other kinds of photography too. So it just depends on what you normally do, what you find yourself shooting, what's more versatile. But I'll tell you, there's so many mid-range zooms out there.
And they're all sharp at f8 or f11 or right in that zone.
Exactly.
They're not terribly different.
Top end anything on this stuff. It's great. And then get a cable release.
Yeah. Anything that we're missing?
No, just...
You know, you can get into the weirder filters and stuff like that, the gold-blue polarizers. And, you know, the one thing I will mention is if you are shooting film, a warming filter, which we've talked about in the past, is very nice.
Yeah, especially in those morning hours.
Yeah.
In the shade.
If you're in the shade, you know, that's where it really can help. If you're out in, you know, where it's sunlit, you definitely don't need one in the morning hours. But that can be a handy thing at times.
Yeah. Well, I think that's probably all. We could spend hours talking about it, but I think that's the basics.
Yeah.
That's all we really need to hit. So just to reminder, we'll have some links to some of these lenses and our suggestions where you can buy some of this stuff. Again, on the show notes page at podcast.nikonians.org. Just find the Image Doctors on there, and we're there, and you can get links to this.
And we'll talk to you again in a couple weeks.
Yeah, and we're going to have probably...
We're going to do the
long-awaited sharpening topic.
Yeah.
So we didn't quite have enough time to finish that for this week, but we're going to digest some more in the next 2 weeks, and we'll bring you that next time.
Yep.
All right. Well, thanks again for listening to us. Don't forget to download all of our podcasts at podcasts.nikonians.org, and we will talk to you in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.